If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
There's two scenarios where I'm going to buy. It's one is I'm walking in from with equity from day one. So I buy something at $600,000, and I know from day one I could turn it around and sell it for $650,000, $675,000. Or two, I buy something for $600,000, I put $200,000 into it, and it's worth $1 million at the end of the day from the moment my tenant moves in. So I'm either creating equity or I'm walking in with equity.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Willie J. Mandrell is a self-made multimillionaire real estate investor, broker, coach, lecturer, and author. As a buyer, seller, and a broker, he's been involved with well over $200 million in real estate transactions. He has been featured in numerous trade magazines, and he's a frequent guest on real estate and wealth-related podcasts, television, and radio shows across the U.S. Will is the author of Cash Flow Secrets, a book on real estate investing and finance tips most people are never taught but need to know. Willie, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you doing? I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, this is great. This is great. Where are you based out of this morning?
Boston, Massachusetts. Cold, rainy, never know what you're going to get, Boston.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think, what did you say? You're waiting on a dumpster delivery right now?
I'm sitting out in front of one of our projects right now. And I'm always on the road for something. But right now, we're waiting on a dumpster swap out. We have the current ones filled up. They're bringing a new one and swapping out the old one.
Oh, man. It's always something in real estate. I don't care how far down the line you get. There's always something interesting that we're dealing with. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Where I started, 2006 timeframe, right before the Great Recession, market crash in 2007, 2008. I bought my first two-family in 2006. My grandparents had been in the business for a little while and encouraged me to kind of push me into that. The market and investing in real estate, buying rental property. I'm glad I listened. I was, fresh out of college and, took some lumps, took some bruises, obviously rolled the entire market down. But in 2000, I would say 9, 10, 11, and then in 12 made some of the best purchases, of my life, and kind of took the advice of Warren Buffett and great investors and, kind of continued to buy when everybody else was kind of running away from the market. So I would say that's where I started. Again, 2012, 13, 14, got my wife involved, got my brothers involved, got my brother-in-law involved, my sister-in-law, just made it kind of a family business and really just kind of grew from there. 2021, we're sitting here about 15 years later. We are, collectively and throughout my family, I personally own somewhere around 60 units. So it'll probably be closer to 75 before the end of the year. But we're well over 100 units throughout my family in terms of the rental market in here in Boston.
Gotcha. So are you guys investing in mostly single family, in multifamily, a mix? What's your...
Everything here in Boston's a triple decker. So it's a three family. We build up, we don't build out. Everything here is 100 years old and it's built upward. So everything's a three decker. I think they're the old 1910, 1920s. Three deckers were built with the idea that you live in one unit, you bring your family on and they live in, separate quarters. They have their own kitchen, their own bathrooms, three bedrooms, but you're all kind of in that same residence together. So now, 100 years later, 100 plus years later, these things are rental properties for everybody. Investors like myself, we go and we buy them and, fix them up. New siding, new kitchens, new bathrooms, new roofing, new electrical, update what needs to be done, and just turn them into rental properties. So the commercial market here, larger residential, big buildings, very, very high barrier to entry. You're talking about, 10 million, 20 million, 30 million plus, just at your entry level. Most of those buildings here are student housing. We obviously have here in Boston is Harvard University, MIT, BU, BC, Northeastern, some of the biggest schools in the and more popular schools in the world. So most of those bigger, larger residential buildings have been taken over by the larger landlords and they cater to that student population. People like myself, we stay in that residential space. you know, and build our portfolio. Not too many single families here. I'd say mostly everything we do is a three or four. Single families just don't make financial sense. You find singles and condos don't make financial sense in high-priced markets like Boston.
Right, right. Yeah, that would seem to make a lot of sense. So each of these you call them triple deckers, do they have, so then that's a three, each of those would have then three separate tenants?
Three separate tenants, exactly. So most of our buildings, if I had 30 units, I probably have 10 buildings, most likely here. If you're talking to somebody and they have 30 units in Boston, then I would almost, you know, count on the fact that they have 10 buildings, because most of them are probably three families.
Right, right. That's an interesting niche. What are some things dealing with housing stock that is that old? What are some problems you guys run into with that?
You end up sitting in front of your projects with dumpsters waiting for dumpsters all the time. No, I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, you have to meet current building code. A lot of times we have things that are grandfathered in. For instance, I think building code throughout, you know, the state says that you're building a new hallway or a new staircase. It needs to be 36 inches wide. New hallway, new staircases. Here we'll have our entryways or staircases or hallways that are, you know, 24 inches wide. And if you go in, you immediately feel the width of these things and how tight they are, but they're grandfathered in. So it's just dealing with stuff like that. For instance, I had a 36 inch fridge that I ordered the other day for the property I'm sitting in front of now, needed to be returned to the store because there was no way it was getting inside the house. So we had to go get a very expensive 30 inch fridge and insert that into the, so yeah, there's, I mean, people are, you know, larger, you know, we're heavier than we were. So just dealing with some of the, you know, low ceiling heights and stuff like that, are some of the challenges you deal with the older, you know, home stock. And then you have you have buildings that are sitting on foundations that are, you know, 100 years old. And sometimes you have some issues there. Sometimes they need to be repointed, or, you know, a lot of times in Boston, I imagine other places in the country, you get a home that's too old, you'll knock it down and just rebuild it. Here we'll actually crank the whole house up, lift it up, repair the foundation, and set the house back down. And sometimes we'll just move the house altogether to another place, which sounds ridiculous. Wow. But that's, you know, that's sometimes what we end up doing here.
Really, really. So I guess, you know, where was I going with that? I had a question that was, we'll cut this out. I'm trying to think of where I wanted to go with that. There was aged house. Oh, inventory. Like, is there plenty of inventory for you guys to acquire because people
don't want to deal with that,
or is it just tough?
Yes, yes and no. I would say that we have an inventory problem just like the rest of the country. If you're a new homeowner right now and you're trying to, for instance, I'll give you a perfect example. My sister-in-law, you know, she's a doctor, you know, decent salary, well-paid. She had close to $1 million pre-approval. Well, you think with $1 million, you should be able to go out and find what you're looking for, right? I mean, that's a decent, you know, a decent number. Trouble finding something that actually makes financial sense. You know, with a million dollar pre-approval, still trouble finding something that actually makes financial sense, because the inventory here is just so tight. We have a lot of people that come here from all over the world. Again, Harvard, MIT, Mass Eye and Ear, some of the best hospitals in the world. They come, they stay. Our population is growing like crazy. Our mayor, who is now the Department of Neighborhood Secretary, Marty Walsh, just went up to the White House, but he called for 70,000, 80,000 more units in the last couple of years and realized there was a serious housing shortage here. We are building everywhere. We're building in former, we take down gas stations and put up 20-story complexes. We take away old parking lots and whatever it is, and we'll build anywhere we absolutely can because there definitely is a housing shortage. So it's a little tough. If you're new and you're trying to get in, the barriers to entry are or can be very intimidating. But the good thing is, once you're in, you're solid. I mean, you start to see housing appreciation. Your house is worth, you know, 50, 60 grand a year later than it was, the year prior when you bought it. So getting in tough, but once you get in, you're financially in a good place often with the real estate in Boston.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So if it's difficult, I guess if it's difficult to find houses, like, you know, what are some things maybe that, you know, what are some things that you guys are doing to find more stock?
You just have to just be competitive. So, I mean, I think a lot of investors, when they go out, and I'm writing my second book, and I'm talking about this a little bit right now. You know, I've talked to other investors in other markets, other states, other cities, and they'll just hop on the MLS and just kind of say, hey, just pick around and just search around and just see what's out there. I haven't bought anything on the MLS or the multiple listing service for my realtor in years. I mean, everything that we do is just mass. We do a lot of mailings. We do a lot of driving for dollars. We do a lot of cold calling, door knocking, and just getting yourself out there. I would say for every 100 leads that hit my desk, I'm probably buying 3 properties. So it's because most of it's just crap. And most of it's overpriced retail stuff where you're walking in and you're not really seeing an opportunity to build any equity, create any sweat equity. So I'm only looking for stuff where I need that needs an extensive amount of work. And to answer your earlier question, yes, there is a little bit of an advantage for me as an investor who has the ability to go in and gut something down to the studs, or has the ability to buy land and, you know, do new construction, because I'm weeding out a lot of the competition now. If I was only looking for rent-ready stuff, stuff that needed a new fridge and a new stove and slight cosmetic stuff, there's a lot of competition for that. But the fact that I'm willing to go in and, you know, take a house that was partially burnt down, or, you know, take something that needs new electrical, new plumbing, new roof, new foundation, new heating system, yes, it does create, I would say there's probably, you know, a handful of investors here in Boston that really have the ability to, you know, take on projects like that.
Right, right. And I think finding your competitive advantage is what you have done that allows you to do that. Yeah, I was curious. So last week I sold and I've got some legacy kind of single family rentals here in the Memphis market that I, you know, back when I was doing single family, and I just decided to sell some a couple weeks ago. And they just disappeared off the market. These are retail investors paying asking price. And I'll be honest, I sold it at a price that it no longer made sense as an investment.
Yeah.
I imagine that, and that's the Memphis market. So it's got to be for you guys. I mean, why are people doing that?
I think because most people are behind the eight ball. And I hope I, you know, made that said that expression right, because this is exactly what Warren Buffett was talking about in 2008. The crowd. You follow the crowd and the majority of the time you're wrong. So right in 2008, 2009, people were fearful. 2010, you know, the word foreclosures getting tossed around, short sales, all these things are crazy. If you're a savvy investor, when everybody else is running right, you're hopping in and saying, yeah, these things are going on sale. Let me grab them now, because I understand that the economy works in cycles. What is happening right now is not, you know, indicative of what's going to happen in the future. So in 2010, if you were hopping in, you're doing really well right now. But what I think is what the people that are buying your retail single families at prices that don't make sense, they are investors that are following the trend versus creating and getting ahead of the trend, right? They're basically seeing a boom, a real estate boom, and they're saying it doesn't really matter because I'm just going to get in and these things are going to be worth more next year. That's not the way you invest. That's speculation. That's just, that's pure speculation when you get in and invest like that. People like yourself and I are getting in and we're saying, I only buy things where, and I was actually writing about this just last night, there's two scenarios where I'm going to buy. It's one is I'm walking in with equity from day one. So I buy something at 600,000 and I know from day one, I can turn it around and sell it for 650, 675. Or two, I buy something for 600,000. I put $200,000 into it and it's worth $1 million at the end of the day from the moment my tenant moves in. So I'm either creating equity or I'm walking in with equity. Whereas investors today are, I think, buying at retail or above and praying that the market helps them build some equity down the road. And I just think that's the wrong thing to do. But the majority of investors, the majority of people are wrong. You have to, you know, often move opposite to the crowd, you know, if you really want to make money in this business.
Right. No, I think that's an excellent point. Are you guys still net buyers, or have you considered becoming a net seller in this market?
For me, I think it all depends on your timeline. For me, I'm 37 right now. I understand that, you know, like I said, most of this stuff I'm going to hold on to for the next 20 years. I understand the population is growing. I understand there's a serious demand for housing here. I understand that if I'm holding on to assets. Now, here's the other thing. If I was 60 today, 65, I'd be out all day long. I'd be gone, because it is ridiculous. The market is absolutely ridiculous right now. But I know for me, if I sell something, even if I can get, you know, above retail or above, if somebody, you know, paid a stupid number for it, I understand by the time I'm ready to retire 20 years from now or whatever that number is, that price is still, the house is still going to be double what it was worth,
right?
You know, today. So for me, I'm looking at, you know, my timeline. I'm 37, you know, 2 young kids, and I'm looking at my timeline is I'm probably going to hit at least another couple market corrections, right? We're probably going to see another market correction soon. I'll probably see another 2 or 3 before I'm ready to get out and kind of cash in. But again, if I was 60, 65, 70, you know, today, I'd be out all day long because I think this market is absolutely crazy. And it sounds like it's going on nationwide.
Yeah, it absolutely is. That's an interesting point you make there, because a lot of people I have found want to get in, make the appreciation, be it a value add play, whatever it is, you know, and then realize that appreciation. But for you, it sounds like you're more of a long-term cash flow investor.
That's exactly right. I think if you are, you know, I've never been the short-term guy. I think, and what a lot of people don't understand is there's a difference between making money and building wealth. Making money, if you're flipping properties, you're not building wealth, right? You're going in, you're, you know, pushing up the value really quickly. And the syndication guys as well, and this is no disrespect to anybody who's syndicating, I just don't see it as a wealth building strategy. I see it as a job. You buy something, you fix it up, and then there's an exit that's scheduled for 5 years. That's cool, but then you make your money, and then you get this big windfall of cash, but then what? Then what do you do with it? Your money is now slow money. It's stop money. It's not working hard for you anymore. You get this cash back into your pocket. Now you're looking for the next deal. Whereas I'm sitting on something where it's spitting off cash for me for day one. The property is appreciating. I'm also paying down the debt. And rents here in Boston, I don't know about the rest of the country, but we've only gone up. Every year, we're seeing a 3%, 4% appreciation in rents. So each year, my cash flow is also increasing as well. And then what I do is I basically just refinance the property that's worth more, and the debt has also been reduced, stretch it back out over 30 years, and increase my cash flow even more, as I go along. So to answer your question, yes, I've always been a long-term, long-term guy. I've always thought more about the future than today. But then at some point, the future will be today, and I'll be looking to, cash out. So,
right. Absolutely. Absolutely. One last question before we jump here into the final four. How do you fund your deals?
A combination of private and commercial financing. So I have I run a networking group. I started back in 2012. It was called Boston Wealth Builders. And we have about 3,000 investors in that group here in Boston. And then a couple of years ago, it was growing so well that we decided to expand, and we're actually in 20 different cities now, including Memphis, and have a small group there. So it's Wealth Builder Nation. To answer your question more directly, a lot of the investors that are in there, I wouldn't say a lot, but a portion of the investors that are in there come to our meetings. They learn what we do, and they don't have the ability to necessarily, let's say they're a doctor and they work 70 hours a week, or they own a law practice and they're consumed by that. They know they need to diversify their money and put it somewhere else. They become private lenders for us, and they say, "Hey, Willie, I see what you're doing. I see the projects that you're working on. Can we get in some capacity? And we'll come in for 10% equity or whatever it may be, or 15% equity. And here, we'll help you get the funding." I take that private funding and I use that as down payment money for my commercial lenders. I just go to a local portfolio lender here in Boston. It's a Needham Bank. It's a Boston Savings. It's a, Eastern Bank, and couple those two financing together. And more often than not, I'm in the deal for, 100% and, none of my own money.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Have you found that, this is a curious question because I'm dealing with something, this exact scenario right now. Have you found that your banks want to underwrite your private lenders since they're the one bringing the capital to the table?
No. I mean, if you structure it correctly and they understand that what you're doing, it depends on how you structure the deal. If your lenders own less than 20% of the equity within a deal, you're fine. They don't need to come on the loan. If you have an equity partner who is a majority stake owner, let's say they own 25, 30%, that is a big, now the banks want that individual to come on the loan. They want their financials. It's a different situation. So most of the time, what we're doing is where our equity partners are our smaller limited partners, LPs, we call them. They come in for less than 20%, 10, 15% of the actual transaction. We may need three of them to complete, the down payment now, but it keeps the transaction clean. So now it's just me personally that's dealing with the bank versus, having to involve our limited partners.
Right. Because I know that scares a lot of LPs away because they don't want that exposure.
No, they don't. Yeah. They don't want that exposure. No. Yep. So their exposure is strictly to the investment that they have within the actual property itself. But they're not personally guaranteeing the loan with the bank or anything else like that. And they understand that, like I said, I'm buying this stuff, 50, 60 cents on the dollar. you know, there's a their money's pretty secure at the end of the day.
Sure, sure. No, that's great. Willie, I've really enjoyed this. Let's jump here into the final four. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
If you're in Boston, understand that the barrier entry is the barriers to entry are high, but understand that once you get in, it's sweet. You know, once you get in, it's sweet. You know, we never really have it, you know, trouble with, you know, finding tenants. You know, vacancy rates are low. Rents are appreciating like crazy. If you're not in Boston, this is a great game. Get into it. Play the game of Monopoly. I played the game of Monopoly when I was a little kid, and that's all I'm doing essentially as an adult. Still playing the same exact game. I'm just playing with real money and real estate at this point. It's a great game. It is, in my opinion, the only true way, or I wouldn't say the only true way, I would say the best way for anyone, regardless of your education, regardless of where you're starting from, to actually build wealth in this country.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. What is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Continuing to educate myself. I read, I write, I talk to, you know, people like yourself, hop on podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I go to as many networking meetings as I possibly can. Things are constantly changing. New opportunity zones are coming out. New building codes are being developed. And the more that I stay abreast with all this stuff, the better off I'll be. Constantly making connections. A good friend of mine, just going out and networking. She's a developer. She had been a developer. Now she's the head of inspectional services here in Boston. And I couldn't be more proud of her, but that's a great connection for me to have, you know, so just continuing to go out. And then also realizing that for newer investors, that other investors are not your competition. They're your colleagues. And understanding that and going out and shaking hands, not just with probate attorneys and eviction attorneys and mortgage brokers, but also other investors. Some of my best deals have come from other investors and other developers within the market.
Right. No, those are all incredible and very, very good points you make there. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one thing you are doing to make the world a better place?
I spend a lot of time trying to, I wouldn't say a lot of time, but I spend as much time as I possibly can trying to, we have the shelter here called the Pine Street Inn. And I spend, I'm in the real estate business. So, the Pine Street Inn is a place where we take in Boston's homeless, make sure they are fed, make sure they are properly clothed, and they have a roof over their head. And I try to spend as much time as I can, not just during the holiday seasons, but in the off seasons, volunteering my time over there. I'm always been a person that I don't really like just throwing money at issues. I like trying to get involved and actually make sure that I'm on site and spending some time helping the problem. So, I'm being in the real estate business, especially during, a global pandemic, you understand the hardships that, some people have. And I try to do everything I can to contribute and give back to, solving, those real estate issues.
Right. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. Good for you. Willie, if the listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
I would check out my YouTube channel. Drop a lot of, investment advice on there, financial literacy stuff, real estate stuff. YouTube.com/WMandrell, W Mandrell. I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. You can connect with me there. I'm on Bigger Pockets. You can check out my website, mandrellco.com, MANDRELLCO.com. And then you can also go to /coaching. And I do a 30-minute free coaching call for any of your listeners as well.
Awesome. Willie, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.